Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the General Assembly in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along. On this edition of the program, President Trump's Supreme Court pick, the Berger-Cooper relationship, and maybe even some details of what to expect in Raleigh during this long and so far quiet legislative session. Coming up, a conversation with State Senate Leader Phil Berger, a Republican from Rockingham County. First, we turn our focus to the district and welcome Time Warner Cable Washington reporter Jeff Bennett. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing.
Donald Trump made a nomination to the High Court this week. Neil Gorsuch is the pick, a federal appellate judge from the 10th Circuit in Denver. What has been the reaction? What can listeners expect next?
Well, the reaction among conservatives is one of relief, frankly. The Trump White House tried to build a lot of suspense with this nomination. The day of the announcement, we knew that it came down to two people, Gorsuch and another judge named Hardiman, who actually had like a blue-collar background, a background that was, frankly, a lot in line with the voters that elevated Donald Trump to the White House. And even at the moment when Donald Trump revealed his pick to be Gorsuch, he even said, you know, was that a surprise? Teeing up the suspense for people in the room. But, you know, the president really, he had a couple of goals in making this first pick. He wanted to find someone in their 40s or 50s with, you know, solidly conservative credentials, meaning that person could serve on the court for at least 25 years. And he definitely found it in Judge Gorsuch. He's, you know, a well-established conservative. He was appointed to the bench, the federal bench, by George W. Bush. And for the most part, he's come down on a lot of cases, and he, you know, supports religious liberty. He, you know, ruled in that the key Hobby Lobby case that companies could not pay for contraceptive coverage in their health care policies if they had some sort of religious objection. And the other thing I think that is worth noting is that Tuesday night, when the president made his selection public, he said this has been the most transparent Supreme Court selection in history. And I have to say that's, you know, that's fairly true. Because you remember he put out that list of, I think he put out two lists really during the campaign, and it was like 21 potential candidates that he would pick from. And the list, we should say, was compiled by the Conservative Heritage Foundation. But Trump said he would pick someone from that list, and that was his way of sending a signal to the conservative base that he wasn't going to, you know, be elected and then pick someone who was more moderate or you know, even decidedly more liberal. So at least in that regard, he kept his campaign promise.
The Supreme Court of the United States, of course, has had eight justices for the last year, nearly the last year. This is the seat that was vacated when Justice Antonin Scalia passed away almost a year ago now. The timeline for what happens next, do you have a sense of that? Can we expect a filibuster? I mean, obviously, the party that is in the minority in the Senate has, I would say, a long tradition here, right, of trying to oppose not all justice nominees, but many of them. What happens from here? What is the anticipated timeline?
Well, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, says he wants to have confirmation hearings for Gorsuch at least by April. Democrats have to figure out whether or not they want to use all their political capital, their political leverage, such that it exists, on this nomination, because the president is appointing a conservative to fill a conservative seat. The thinking is that if, you know, they force, if they do obstruct as best they can and hold things up, that the Republicans will, you know, kill the filibuster and then reduce the threshold to 51 votes, a simple majority. Republicans have 52 members in the Senate, so they would, you know, if they did that, then Gorsuch would be easily approved. And of course, President Trump has suggested that the Senate take the nuclear option. That's the, you know, the idea of killing the filibuster and reducing that threshold. But for right now, we just have to kind of wait and see. I'll tell you, the Democratic base for sure wants an all-out fight because they feel like the seat was stolen from them since the Republicans held up Merrick Garland's nomination for essentially a year, and it basically killed his nomination outright. And, you know, Democrats have learned that there's no price to pay, really, for obstruction because Republicans were rewarded for it in this instance. And the other thing they say, too, Democrats, the Democratic base, is that because Donald Trump didn't win the popular vote, he doesn't really have the mandate he thinks he has. So that is another reason why the Democratic base wants the Democratic leadership to stall. And, you know, they were at the Supreme Court Monday night, I believe it was, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, all rank-and-file members having, you know, their own little protest event, for lack of a better phrase. And there were people in the crowd yelling at them, you know, to say, saying, walk the walk and don't give up and, you know, you have to fight this. So we'll see how much they hew to that.
Sure. So to be clear, the Democrats cannot stop Judge Gorsuch from moving forward and getting a full, you know, committee hearing and Senate vote. To the best of my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong there. So from a political standpoint, what do the Democrats gain by digging their heels in and, you know, doing everything possible to slow this process down or object to this nominee? Is it simply standing strong and playing to the base?
More or less. I mean, Democrats believe that the sequence of events we've seen this past week, I mean, including the executive order on immigration, the controversial executive order on immigration, and then Trump's decision to fire the then acting attorney general who refused to defend it, and then his nomination of Jeff Sessions, who many believe has a philosophy that is at odds with the mission of the Justice Department. All of that, they feel, is not only overreach, but an abuse of power. And so this idea of contesting the Supreme Court pick, based on all of what I just said and the fact that they also feel like the seat was stolen from them, is more political than anything else. So, you know, as you said, you know, Republicans, Mitch McConnell is the Senate Majority Leader. He controls the calendar. He controls essentially what happens in that chamber. So no, I mean, if he wants to call for a confirmation hearings, he can definitely do that, and I'm sure he will. But it's more so that coming off his bruising defeat in November, that Chuck Schumer and then other Democrats in charge, Nancy Pelosi and the rest of them, really have to send a signal to the base.
Jeff Bennett is your guest on the WUNC Politics podcast. He's a Time Warner Cable Washington reporter. Jeff, you've done some reporting this past week and recent weeks on the executive order, the one pertaining to immigration. The White House seems to be doubling down on this. How come?
Well, they say that polling appears to be in their favor. The White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, he pointed to a Rasmussen poll that showed 57% of Americans favored a temporary ban on refugees. Now, Rasmussen is not all that reliable, and it's not all well-conducted poll on the whole. But there is another Reuters poll that is more reliable that shows that 66% of Americans agree with the idea that the U.S. should limit refugees, which it already does, and the vetting process that was in place during the Obama administration takes about 2 years, if not longer than that. So they point to that polling to show solid support for their position. And then beyond that, if you look at it along partisan lines, 51% of Republicans said that they agreed that you know that the executive orders are needed and do make sense. So, you know, if you look to the campaign, this idea that, you know, the political lesson that Donald Trump seems to have learned from the campaign is that division works, and sort of like the point that Democrats are making really doesn't hold up in his eyes because he thinks that the policy is sound and that beyond that, the politics works in his favor.
Jeff Bennett is a Washington-based reporter for Time Warner Cable News. He joined us from the Hill. Just ahead, a conversation with the man many call the most powerful player in North Carolina politics, Republican Senate Leader Phil Berger. Stay tuned. This is the Politics Podcast on WUNC.
Hi, this is John Darnielle from the Mountain Goats. This is one of our songs. It's in the mix at WUNC Music.
But I am just a broken machine, and I do things that I don't really mean. Long black night.
You can hear that song and discover lots of other great stuff on WUNCmusic.org. Are you listening?
Welcome back. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. The long legislative session is underway at the General Assembly here on Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, but the first couple of weeks have been almost suspiciously quiet. No formal votes have yet to take place. Remember, the main function for lawmakers during this session is to pass a state spending plan. That'll take place in the coming months. And of course, there will be other policy and political issues that emerge. For a preview of perhaps some of what's coming, also an update on HB2 discussions, I sat down with Senate Leader Phil Berger for just a few minutes earlier this week. As he entered a conference room for our conversation, he noticed some pins that are on a bag I use to carry around audio equipment. That's where we began.
Flew on the shuttle, the Piedmont shuttle.
Were you a Piedmont Airlines flyer?
Long time ago, yeah. You don't look old enough.
I'm not old enough. My wife grew up in Thomasville.
It's another one talking about how old I am.
No.
She got me an old Piedmont Airlines t-shirt for Christmas a few years ago, and I'm a nerd, so I found a handful of old buttons online.
I grew up in Danville, and Piedmont used to have air service in Danville, and it was just a crushing blow to folks' pride there when we no longer had commercial air service. And that's been, I mean, gosh, that's probably been 40 years ago.
Totally unrelated and wasn't expecting to ask you about Piedmont. What's like your number one memory of Piedmont Airlines?
I was just a kid and just getting on a plane. It was my, you know, I mean, nothing other than that.
Sure.
If you would, I'm interested in chatting briefly about the outline, the agenda for the long legislative session, if there are perhaps are some details, two or three specific pieces of policy or kinds of changes or proposals that you're expecting in the next few months that you're willing to talk a little bit about. Give your constituents, our listeners, just a sense of what's going to happen in this long legislative session from a policy standpoint.
Sure. From a policy standpoint, I actually don't know that you're going to see a lot of major policy shifts this time. I will be the first to acknowledge, however, that that can change rather rapidly. We tend to see things happen in North Carolina, particularly in the last several years, that might jump up that you're not really anticipating. My thought on this session is that for the most part, we're going to be looking to work on a lot of the things that we've worked on in the past, making sure the budget is balanced, trying to deal with what a lot of our folks and a lot of people in North Carolina feel is a real concern, and that's the growth of government, and try to make sure that we maintain some control over that growth. I think we want to monitor and look at where we are in terms of our competitiveness with other states. I'm a big believer that under our federal system, each state has an opportunity to do what it can to attract people to the state, to make the state more competitive. And that's one of the things that we've been trying to do, particularly in connection with our tax policy and our regulatory policy. The other thing that I think is important is for us to continue to monitor and to work on some of the education initiatives that have been instituted in the last 6 years. One of them is dealing with the teacher pay structure and trying to continue to move North Carolina in the right direction in terms of how we compensate our public school teachers. We've made great strides there, put a good bit of the taxpayers' money into that effort. We've got to the point where the average teacher pay now is over $50,000. Our goal over the next couple of years is to get it over $55,000, and I think we're on track to do that. A lot of the things that we've done in other areas has given us the capacity to do those sorts of things. Some of the tax reforms that we're seeing revenues exceed what projections are. So, none of that sounds real exciting like in 2013 we were going to do tax reform or, some of the other things in our first session we were going to do medical malpractice reform. But we've done a lot of those larger issues, and I think right now what we're trying to do is make sure we can stay the course, make sure that the things that we've done are continuing to work.
It has started quietly around here the last couple of weeks, maybe not in your office, but for some of us downstairs in the press corps, it seems to have been quiet. I've heard from people in this building, I've heard from people outside of this building, that there are discussions that continue about repeal of HB2. Where do those efforts stand at this point?
So there is some discussion about HB2, and of course on one side it's repeal of HB2. On the other side, there are a lot of folks in this building who are saying we don't need to do anything with HB2. I actually think that there is a need to continue the discussion. I think if we're going to do something to move from where we are, if folks are dissatisfied with where we are on that particular issue, it's going to take some compromise. And so I don't think straight repeal is going to occur. I think it's a very difficult thing for that to be accomplished, and I don't know that it satisfies the concerns that people have. And I think we do nothing is something that will continue to have some reverberations in terms of concerns from folks. One of the frustrating things for me about this is that a lot of the folks that are saying just repeal HB 2, particularly those that are in the Senate, had an opportunity to vote to repeal HB 2, and they chose not to do that. In fact, those same people were folks who refused to vote at all when HB 2 was being considered. And so I think that's something that I think people need to look with some skepticism on the sincerity of those cries to repeal HB 2.
You have been the lead man on the ship here for several years. House Bill 2 is something that didn't start in this body. I guess it could end in this body, but it didn't start in this body. How frustrating has the whole apparatus of House Bill 2 been, thinking of it through the vantage point of, it was an outside distraction. It was something that you all didn't really ever intend to take up or deal with. I guess speak to the nature of it being an outside distraction and outside forces when they do occasionally have influence on this building and y'all's efforts.
So HB 2 was in many respects a response to a particular ordinance that was adopted in the city of Charlotte, an ordinance that many people felt created a loophole that created a safety concern for folks as far as restrooms and locker rooms and shower facilities. And so it was a response to that. But in some respects, it was a larger response, or a response to a larger issue, and that is, what is the appropriate interface between state government and local government? And for a long period of time, and I think it continues, North Carolina was known as a Dillon's Rule state, which basically means that the authority that a city or a county has is that authority that is delegated from the state, from the General Assembly.
It's still a Dillon's Rule state, isn't it?
It is still a Dillon's Rule state. If you look at the Constitution, it's fairly clear in the state constitution. And so House Bill 2 was something that I think was a larger issue, although I think a lot of the focus has been on the whole question about what are the appropriate things that should be in place to address discrimination or fears of discrimination, and what are the appropriate things that should be in place to address concerns about safety. But it really also had to do with, what are the sorts of things that a city can do? Is it appropriate for a city in North Carolina as a Dillon's Rule state to deal with things such as anti-discrimination laws? Is it appropriate for a city in North Carolina to deal with things like the minimum wage? All of those sorts of things, and so it was a little bit larger. And your question was about the outside influences and the distractions, and I think that response was a response that probably reflected something more than just the immediacy of the Charlotte ordinance. It was seeing some larger things going on that were of concern to a lot of people.
Governor Roy Cooper, would you be more likely to sit down and have a coffee or a beer with the governor?
Coffee.
Okay. Have you had that recently?
We spoke, and I think I was offered coffee. I'm sure it was available. I'm not. Quite frankly, I'm not a big beer drinker, and I'm not a big coffee drinker. But we met, I guess it's been about 2 weeks ago is the last time we sat down and talked.
The confirmation process, are you confident that when the hearing, I believe as it's still scheduled for February 8th, when Larry Hall is scheduled to have a confirmation hearing, that he's going to be in that seat and take some questions?
You'll have to talk to Mr. Hall about that. I'm confident that the Constitution provides the Senate with an advising consent function in connection with those appointments. I'm confident that the members of the Senate will take that advising consent obligation and responsibility seriously. I'm confident that the Senate is interested in whether or not the various nominees are qualified to do the job, whether or not those nominees have a conflict of interest of some sort, and whether or not those nominees are people who will abide by the law and will follow what the law is, as opposed to what their personal preferences would be in connection with things.
Well, I feel like we've heard a lot about this rural-urban divide, more so perhaps with the last general election. You are from a rural district. I'm wondering what ideas, if any, you have, whether they're initiatives or improvements, things that your body can do, things that local of elected officials can do, things that regular citizens, your constituents, can do to try to improve upon what at times feels like a crater. At times it feels like there's a large divide there between rural and urban folks in this state. How can North Carolina improve upon that?
So the first thing I would say is it's not something that's unique to North Carolina. I think if you read what's going on in other states, you have a similar circumstance occurring where the more urbanized areas tend to be different philosophically, politically than the rural areas. So it's cultural. It's also economic because society, and again, not just in North Carolina, but in many parts of the country, a lot of the growth, a lot of the prosperity, a lot of the opportunity seems to be either moving toward or existing in those more urbanized areas. And so that's creating some conflicts. I think what we can do is, one, be aware of it, two, look for common ground as much as we can find it, and three, try to adopt strategies. And I don't know that anybody has really hit on the silver bullet as far as this is concerned, but adopt strategies that help level the growth so that it occurs not just in the more urbanized areas, but that the rural areas as well. One of the great things in North Carolina is while we do have the rural-urban divide, one of the real successes we've had economically in North Carolina is with agriculture. I mean, our agricultural incomes, our agricultural outputs, our agricultural exports have grown tremendously over the past 15 or 20 years. And I think that's a real success story that sometimes gets hidden in the discussion of the rural-urban divide.
Anything else? I know you're on a tight schedule.
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
All right, I appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was my conversation from earlier this week with Rockingham County Republican Phil Berger. He's the Senate pro tem here at the North Carolina General Assembly. That's it for this edition of the podcast. As always, thanks for clicking play. And as a reminder, we would always love to hear from you. Questions, comments, political trivia, whatever. Send it our way through social media or email. WUNC is entering a winter fundraiser next week. If you have already supported the station, thank you. And if you've yet to make a contribution, consider a pledge of, I don't know, $5-$10 a month. More than half of our funding altogether comes from listeners just like you. And if you're a fan of good old factual journalism, you can help keep the station strong moving into the future. Pledge online at WUNC.org or call 1-800-962-9862. And don't forget to subscribe to the WUNC Politics podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. That's all for now. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Talk to you again soon.